Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
I can hear both of us.
How about that?
Okay. Hopefully it's getting both of us. Okay. November 11th.
That's okay. True.
Today is September 11th, 2014, and it's Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing with our conversations about Dave's life. And today we thought we'd talk a little bit about some of his international biological work. And so, Dave, why don't you set the scene and tell us, when did you start doing some work in other countries?
Well, other than Canada and working sometimes with students from Yukon and working with species that were overlapped, like the porcupine caribou herd, plus students, I had students from Canada who were involved in the waterfowl studies, which tied in with waterfowl studies in Alaska. And
Well, you did a sabbatical year in Norway, right?
1971, 72.
So was that your sort of introduction to...
Not really. Before that, I think it was 1965 was that first trip to Europe, and that was tied to a contract or grant I had from the Bureau of Land Management, mm-hmm. where I was doing some studies on the reindeer that were introduced, feral reindeer that had been introduced to islands in the Aleutians, Adak, for example,
Shemya.
No, that time, in addition to Adak, there were, while I was doing a little bit of studies on reindeer been introduced to the Pribilofs and doing some work on reindeer ranges to look at compared lichen growth rates where the work had been started by L.J. Palmer, who was one of the early wildlife biologists in Alaska, but he was associated with Native Service, I think.
Alaska Native Service, or is that what it was called?
Yeah, in territorial days.
It wasn't the Bureau of Indian Affairs, it was before that.
It was before that, and then it turned into the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
Yeah.
And then he was a top-notch biologist. He was based sometimes out of the experimental station here, Fairbanks, and he had started studies on lichens on the reindeer ranges, and so he had actually established plots and did certain treatments, different treatments to the plots. A group of plots in an area. And this was back in the 1920s and maybe early 30s, but when there were a lot of reindeer. And but then he died of a heart attack in a hotel in Anchorage, and I forget the year that happened. It was in the 1940s. And so I had a student who did a master's project and designed to relocate these plots and do an assessment of what the status was of the lichen growth on those areas. And I was working in out of places like Unalakleet, where we knew there were we could relocate the plots, and on Nunavak Island, and one or two other locations. Yeah, the Seward Peninsula. And so...
Well, you mentioned that on the Aleutians and Nunavak, reindeer were introduced.
Yeah.
Why were they introduced and when?
Well, reindeer were introduced to Alaska about 1897, I think.
Was that all the Sheldon Jackson?
Yes.
I know about that in the north. I didn't realize.
And that included, they moved them to Nunavak soon after they were brought to the Seward Peninsula, partly because it was an island and they didn't have to be herded there, but they were under the, they were managed by the native people in the Mercuriac village there. And subsequently, they were able to build, get money for a slaughterhouse and did a lot of processing of into the build corrals and what. But so then the BLM wanted me to do studies on Adak and Umnak, where the reindeer were in the Aleutians. And so I got out to on a contract with them to both those islands, and did collected a few animals to look at body condition, and then looked at lichen status of lichens on the islands. And those islands said that animals had been introduced very early on in the 1920s or so. And the idea was that the villagers would be able to hunt them or corral them, if possible, if they wanted to do that. But mostly those natives in the Aleutians were so oriented toward marine mammals and the sea that they didn't really want to do this, even though there were some sheep grazing, sheep ranches and land lease on some of those islands, Umnak, for example, where there were there was competition between, well, they assumed there might be competition between sheep and, because the sheep populations were not harvested well because there was no, it was mainly for the wool production. But if they're going to harvest for lamb, they had to have slaughter facilities and inspectors come out during that period of time. And whereas the wool was not such a problem, and they could ship the wool usually on the native service vessel, North Star, I think it was, back. And so they didn't have a lot of freight costs associated with the that, whereas if they were to handle meat, they'd have problems with getting the meat to market.
Well, as I say, I knew about reindeer being introduced, you know, on the North Slope and the Seward Peninsula, but I didn't realize all the way down to the Aleutian Islands.
Yep. And they initially increased, but we don't have any good record on whether they peaked out and declined like one might expect when they overgrazed lichens. But the general assumption was that they didn't undergo major cycles. They stabilized in relationship to what would be carrying winter carrying capacity. But it was higher in the Aleutians because those were much further south than the Bering Sea Islands. And
so there was enough lichen for them to eat that the...
No, it was more, there was a longer period when green vegetation was available. And often, all winter long, they wouldn't get snow right down to sea level. It'll be up in the mountains where the snow would occur, and the animals could come down and feed on green vegetation, which is good if it's available, mm-hmm. but it mostly isn't available in the Arctic, not in sufficient quantity for them to depend on it.
Yeah, I kind of think they would have eaten themselves out of house and home.
Well, there's been some experiments when reindeer were brought, early ones, they were brought from Norway down to Antarctica to the the islands, Georgia Island,
yeah. South Georgia Island.
Yeah. And the Norwegians had a whaling station there. Mm-hmm. And so they thought they would introduce reindeer. And the reindeer there did, they had a limited area because of glaciers that would prevent their movement too broadly. But they limited the lichens, but and they limited a lot of other vegetation because even though it's Antarctica region, it's very mild winters because there's no sea ice year-round around there. So they were used for that purpose, and they ate out a lot of plant species, ate out lichens, and then they, instead of crashing, they were able to graze heavily on a couple of sedge species or grass species mm-hmm. that were resistant to grazing and actually benefited somewhat from elimination of other competing plants. And then down by the beach where there were southern fur seals that hauled out, they would knock down the other vegetation, but didn't the tussock forming ones, the fur seals actually were fertilizing them, and so they were able to sustain grazing pressure by the South Georgia reindeer, and so they didn't disappear. They stabilized at a certain level. And then one time they found their way across the glacier and started a new population. And that new population started out with a lot of lichens, and then they limited the lichens in the new area as well.
Well, I guess it makes sense that, yeah, you're the carrying capacity concept where, let's say you introduced 100 reindeer, but the environment could only sustain 50, you left with 50 and they do fine.
Right. Yep, that's true. But in the subarctic, like in the St. Matthew Islands, the winter is pronounced seasonality, whereas you get into the Aleutian Islands, it's not as pronounced. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's cool summers, but cool and mild winters. And it was very maritime climate. So you get good growth of grazing vegetation. You didn't have any shrubs to interfere very much with lichen growth. And where there's high competition between, say, beach rye, which grows tall, it would shade out the lichens, so they couldn't grow in with that. And that the beach rye would form usually along the beach, but after a volcanic eruption with a lot of ash, they would invade these other areas, which in those conditions, it was good grazing for domestic sheep and cattle, but not so good for the reindeer. Reindeer would try to get into the mountains where there was more plant diversity and they could be more selective feeders, which was usually not where the sheep or the cattle were grazed. So at any rate, then the Bureau of Land Management wanted to fund me to go to Northern Scandinavia to learn something from reindeer grazing on the rangelands there. So that was, I looked forward to that experience and made contacts, and then went over there and worked mainly in grazing areas in northern Sweden. And then this was areas were grazed by the Sami-controlled reindeer mm-hmm. herds. So we had a lot of baseline data. And then there was one senior biologist who had published a book in Swedish on the best work at that time on lichens. And he was trained as a forester, but he became very interested in lichens and forest ecology and how it affected lichens and how lichens were of value to the reindeer herders and the conflict of certain types of forestry. And so I was in, at that time, the U.S. had some money, foreign monies, that they could pay for translation and publication of important books and journals in foreign languages. And so I was able to get that book translated in India, I think, to English and published there. And then it was made available through the Biological, published in the Biological Papers, I think. Was it? I think so.
Is the Biological Papers a national publication?
About Biological Papers of the University of Alaska.
Okay.
I think, but I'm not.
What was that Swedish biologist's name? Do you remember?
I do, but I can't remember. Can't pull it out at the moment. He was, at the time when I went over there, I met with him first, but he was long since retired, and he was about 80. And I was impressed by him. And I visited him and his wife, and his wife was a few years younger than him, but she was... he wanted to drive, and she said, "You know, good enough driver any longer." He was a very nice guy, and he really appreciated that this was going to be translated and get out.
And this was 1965? When you were there.
That was when to the Northern, where I made contact with some of the reindeer, the biologists from usually Uppsala, where they had a program where they were doing some studies on reindeer ranges. And I went out accompanied by two or three people, visited reindeer research stations. Some of them were really novel because you had to hike in 4 miles or so into the sort of open forest habitat that was grazed open, so it had a lot of lichens on the forest floor, a lot of pine, and that was really a great experience, and stayed in towns, in hotels, but we stayed in these research stations if we were there, and up to eat Swedish food and reindeer, and hiked around through the range areas.
So the research stations were set up by the university in Uppsala.
By the government, I think.
Oh,
Swedish government.
And they, were they in
through
Sami,
the university? Yeah,
through the university. And were they in Sami territory? The reindeer going through this range were herded by Sami people. Or they were wild reindeer?
No, they were semi-domestic reindeer. that were herded seasonally. They were moved into different ranges usually. But this one research station that we hiked into was sort of like, I think it belonged to the government. It was like a model herd. And there was the Samis that were running the station, but some of the Swedes would come to do the botanical studies and stay there periodically and then go back to the university where they had teaching jobs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And but this was, I didn't realize at the time how fortunate I was. And one of the areas I visited was National Park. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was accessible by railroad. The railroad that went to from the big iron mines in Kaerna in north of the Arctic Circle, and the railroad went through the mountains to a port in Norway, mm-hmm. called Norvik. And this was the Germans occupied Norway during the Second World War. They wanted badly the iron ore. And
they wanted that port at Norvik also.
They wanted the port, and then they wanted other ports up there for submarines bases. But it was mainly they wanted to control the shipping, and the submarines partly to control the shipping, as well as the clobber, the land-lease fleets that were going across the North Atlantic. But they wanted to assure that the iron ore would get to Germany. And so the submarines were of importance for protecting them. But they were bombed. The port was bombed a lot by the British and Americans from England.
I think I know the national park you're referring to, and I can't remember the name of it.
I'll think of the name pretty soon, too.
I want to say it begins with an A, but...
Abisko, right.
A-B-I-S-C-O.
And there was the Swedish biological station, botanical station, that was located there. It had been there for many years and continues to be an important studies of alpine, subarctic flora and fauna. And so they got to visit the research station then, as well as that area with one of the biologists. And it later became the study area, and the higher mountains became important downhill ski area, because it was accessible from both Norway and Sweden for recreation. It was by the railroad.
Right.
Now there's a road that was finally built paralleling the railroad and through that area, but it wasn't there then. So at any rate, that was a great opportunity for me to get this experience, and along with people trained to do this work. And then that led to further studies that I did on the and I had other opportunities to get there to northern Sweden and work with another lichen specialist that was becoming, the senior lichen specialist.
So at these research stations, what kind of research were they doing? They were researching the reindeer, the lichen?
No, not at the Abisko station, but at the other station. I forget the name of the town that it was closest to. It was more in the wintering range of the reindeer, not the high mountains. The kind of research they were doing there is where's the best places to, how to deal with the reindeer feeding effectively during the insect season. And of course, one way, in that place there was one low mountain that just barely got up above tree line, and that was where they could herd animals if there was a breeze blowing. But they also built these lean-to shelters, and they would put collect these fungus that grows on trunks of trees, dead trees.
Like punk.
Shelf.
Yeah, that shelf fungus?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they would burn that, and it would burn without flaming and create a smoke that would effectively keep the mosquitoes away. They had built these fires right at the entrance to these lean-tos so the animals could go inside the lean-to or just stand there in the smoke. And when the insects were so bad that they couldn't feed anyway, and so they could at least not be bitten so badly and harassed. And then when it cooled off, maybe at night enough, the mosquitoes went down, then they could go out and graze, but they knew how where to go, come back to places like that. And they were trying things like salt blocks of different kinds to so they meet mineral requirements, et cetera. And they weren't doing really too many controlled studies. They were doing those kind of studies with reindeer were being done in Norway. I visited that research station also in Norway. The guy that ran that was Sven, S-V-E-N, Schenneberg, S-J-E-N-N-E-B-E-R-B, Sven Schenneberg. And he was a good scientist and well-trained, and he did some classic work showing that, you know, that reindeer couldn't do well on just pure lichens. They had to have some green vegetation. And it turns out they even showed that all you have to do is add some urea to pellets of along with the lichens, and reindeer would eat more lichens. What they needed was this nitrogen. Lichens have very low nitrogen levels, and the lichens are digested effectively by caribou and reindeer by microorganisms that are specialists for helping them digest the lichens. So if they just have fewer going into the winter, especially when they're in grazing, they don't have these high populations of the microorganisms for lichen during the summertime. If there's a little, they usually take a little lichen if they're grazing where there's lichen available, but in a lot of marginal forest lands and marginal reindeer grazing areas where farmers frequently would have reindeer and let them graze with cattle, put bells on them and then round them up in the winter and put them in paddocks where they, and feed them hay. Well, the reindeer didn't do very well if they were just fed on hay. And they would prefer lichens. And if you gathered lichens, which is some places they had done this, they would feed on the lichens, but they didn't digest lichens well if you made a quick transition from green vegetation or dried off vascular plants in comparison to pure lichens. Hmm. So they found early on that was the local people said, well, you can speed it up a little bit by giving them sugar beet pulp. In other words, what's left after you squeeze the sugar juices out sugar beets, which in that was the main, in Scandinavia, the main source of sugar was sugar beets. So the pulp was used to feed cattle too. And that speeded up the microorganisms' adaptation to lichens by, instead of taking 2 weeks to adapt, they could do it in a week, perhaps.
Well, again, sugar, it's the solution to everything, right?
Well, no, because they could do even better, they found, if they use high-quality alfalfa hay that was chopped up, so that reindeer and caribou don't like long fiber stuff. If you chop it up, they can handle it better. And the alfalfa has a high nitrogen content. It's because it's a pea family, and they fix nitrogen. And so they don't, the in the wintertime, of course, they don't need a lot of nitrogen because their tissues are not growing significantly. And this is true of most northern ungulates. But they need the energy, especially caribou, because they're digging through the snow for the food and migration and movements. They move around. They're very selective feeders, going from one place to another to dig for lichens. Well, the transition in the wild is simple. If they're in mountain areas where there's some lichens, they'll eat a little lichens all summer long, and it's not a big deal to go to almost complete lichens. But in these controls experiments where they had them in paddocks and could restrict what they're getting, they would offer them as much lichens as they could eat, and they wouldn't be able to maintain their body weight on pure lichens. If they added a little bit of pelletized alfalfa hay, or the sugar beets were not comparable to the alfalfa hay, and they narrowed it down to as many lichens and mainly nitrogen, and the nitrogen is not so much needed initially by the caribou, it's needed by the microorganisms. So the microorganism population could build up sufficiently to handle a lot of large quantities of lichens. And then they turn over, the population of microorganisms turning over all the time. And it goes down in the lower gut, and instead microorganisms are digested in a conventional way by the caribou and reindeer, and then that nitrogen is available to them. The amino acids that are associated with the nitrogen are available to them, but in the winter they don't need as much of that, but the lichens have high energy content. They're mainly a complex starch, and so they need a lot of energy, but you have to be able to digest it, and the microorganisms are the key to digestion. But the microorganisms cycle on the basis of having sufficient. They need some of that energy too from this digesting the lichens, but they need the nitrogen. So you found that you can get urea as a food supplement for cattle, and they get some of that, which is mainly nitrogen, and that they could put on weight and eat more lichens once they started feeding urea along with the lichens, and they put on much better body condition and put on fat reserves in the winter versus the ones that had just straight lichens and nothing else. So they were much healthier under those conditions. Hmm. That was pretty classic stuff, and so it was great for me to get exposed to all this stuff. And fortunately, these people, university people, were all fluent in English, so I didn't have to learn Swedish and Norwegian, and then later Finnish or Russian for working in these northern grazing areas. And then that led to, there was a conference I was able to attend, International Game Biology Conference in Stockholm, I think, at the end of that trip, and it was coordinated around that. And then I met this young Norwegian student, Egil Reimers, who was working starting his PhD studies on caribou in Norway. So he invited me to come and visit a study area there, because it was the study area was a place where I was already involved in the impact of roads and obstructions, linear obstructions, water pipelines in Norway, interfering with the movement of the caribou. They weren't long migratory movements, but they were seasonal movements that frequently were obstructed. And of course, for hydro development in Norway, they would dam and divert streams and dam suitable grazing habitat in the mountains for the caribou. So they were beginning to be concerned. By that time, they discovered oil at Prudhoe Bay, and the question was, you know, pipelines versus caribou. And so I was able to visit these areas where, yeah, the railroad had caused from between, when they built the railroad between Oslo and Trondheim, it went through this alpine area and sort of split, prevented the herd from migrating into within a national park area, from migrating across railroad. It was mainly the railroad, and then later a road along the railroad. And so then you had this one side where lichens were lush, and then overgrazing on the other side. And this remained controversial, though, because there were, at that time, the oil industry was encouraging Canadian biologists to look at northern Alaska and say that, well, the food's never going to be a problem. You know, it's mainly hunting and by natives and non-natives, and then predators, wolves. Mm-hmm. And so they weren't, again, this was when the habitat was being, trying to play down the role of habitat for caribou, which, the general hypothesis of a Canadian, Tom Bergerud, who was from Newfoundland, had done doctoral studies on the Newfoundland caribou, which was kind of a unique situation because they had no wolves and they had a strong maritime climate influence there. But the conclusion was that, you know, wolves on the mainland herds, all the big herds all the way across Canada and including Alaska by Bergerud, was that caribou space themselves out if they can have the opportunity. And they're never limited by food. They're always limited by predators, and it's mainly wolves and humans as predators. There was a big controversy then between those of us working in the university here with the Canadian Wildlife Service people working with the porcupine herd as to what was the limiting factors for caribou. And of course, at that time, the oil industry the Arctic Refuge hadn't been established. It had just been established with the, then under the national interest lands, that the coastal plain was not protected from possible future oil development and initiates studies that we were very much involved with through the university and the teams with the Institute of Arctic Biology, my students and me, and working with the Yukon Wildlife Branch and the Canadian Wildlife Service out of Whitehorse, working in the northern Yukon as well as northern Alaska. And But we always had to contend with this Burger Road. And it tied in with the Wolf guy,
Gordon
Haber's work. He was a student then, and he maintained, at first Burger thought he was God's gift to wildlife biology. He thought Gordon was that. But then the two of them crossed swords, and Gordon was coming across that, you know, wolves are not going to control the caribou, and Burger was, oh, you're all wet, you know. And the both of them were experts at using statistics to prove their point rather than in an objective way, science. And so it was embarrassing. We started with this work at the university here. It was myself, Bob White, and Jack Lewick. Jack Lewick was a senior person working with the lichens and caribou, and some of that was tied to the atomic testing of bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Testing of atomic bombs in the atmosphere, and Russian as well as American, and then finding that the lichens accumulated strontium, I guess it was, radioactive strontium, which then would have potential negative effects on people, but it also showed that the lichens were very adapted to absorbing these radioisotopes. Cesium and strontium were the two important ones from atomic testing. And that continued on through the Chernobyl disaster. And the Swedes were among the first to make this connection. And then we got involved here with the Atomic Energy Commission was supporting studies and funding studies to work with the Nunavut people, and they even flew in a whole body counter and found that the highest levels that have been recorded in humans were women who were eating a lot of bone marrow from killed caribou, and caribou was their primary diet, and the concentration of the cesium was frequently in the bone marrow. And so this led to, and there had been some cases of cancer that were thought to be, but they weren't able to specifically tie it to that. But that, of course, had a big effect on reaction to atomic testing. It was stopped shortly after that, and that was one of the reasons for testing in the atmosphere, not testing in the atmosphere. And then there was the Cape Thompson proposal after the Second World War to use atomic energy to blast so-called initially harbors or harbor on the northwest coast at Cape Thompson near Point Hope, where it's a important native village. And
that's the one we know of as Project Chariot.
Right. And this is where the university got involved, and it was well-funded biological studies, the first good studies on the whole system effect of something of this nature. But a certain naivety by university, they didn't realize how the attitude of the Atomic Energy Commission was that we not do it in Alaska because there aren't many people here and they're just natives close there. And of course, that was the worst case scenario, and the natives were dependent upon the caribou, and if there was heavy radiation effect, the caribou would be unconsumable safely for the because of the radiation following the explosion. And then it turned out, you know, it was just an experiment. They claimed, you know, the more studies of the engineering said, you know, they couldn't be sure it's going to create an harbor, and it'd be megabucks required if it was, and what good is going to be because it's frozen in the wintertime anyway. And and of course this led to the Firecracker Boys and the president of the university, unfortunately, siding with the Atomic Energy Commission at the cost of Alaskan lives, right, and well-being.
Well, you mentioned the theory about the caribou would spread out and they weren't limited by food, and it was predators was their limitation. Did that prove to be correct, or you...
No, it didn't prove to be correct. And the problem is that to make a generalization about caribou across the North American continent with all of these separate herds, and it was, again, not paying enough attention to habitat. And there was a study done before statehood, sort of like almost a sociological kind of study, where Aldo Leopold's son, Starker Leopold, who was then a faculty member and head of the Museum of Vertebrate Ecology at Berkeley, where they did the wildlife habitat and wildlife ecology studies, he was asked to be part of a two-person oversight group to come to Alaska, and the other person was Frank Fraser Darling, who was a English-Scottish biologist and professor who had a lot of experience with the population dynamics and studying the relationship of red deer to natural vegetation and seasonal variability, and how, because there were island populations, how what were the limiting population size.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned them before, and they wrote a book, right?
Right, yeah.
A classic.
Yeah. And that, as a result of their visiting several areas and a lot of flying around during that period, they concluded that a major factor, not the only one, but a major factor for the decline of caribou at that period of time across northern North America, of the big herds, was instead of being overhunting by native people or wolves, was primarily forest fires on the winter range, and a period when forest fires had, quite a few fires had occurred, especially in Canada and Alaska. And there were studies that sort of verified that in terms of the fires, but not, you can't say that, because you didn't have hard data to say it was the sole cause. But it tended to play down this idea that there's always going to be food abundance. Mm-hmm. And
and what year was the Leopold Darling work, or approximate?
That was in 1952, I think.
Okay.
And that's approximately when the book was published, a year or two later. And so, going back overseas,
right,
that first trip was very meaningful for me. And I had been, 1965, yeah, I had been corresponding with, because of at that time I had just finished up my PhD work down in working with deer in Southeast Alaska, where I was studying ecology and food availability and islands, comparing island situations. but pretty much a natural without human impact of hunting pressure wasn't that great a factor. Wolves were involved in the study, but I had started a study, which that was my PhD work. Anyway, I published that, so I was gained some recognition as being a understanding deer ecology in not just Alaska, but in North America. And so I was following my interests and contacted people at a research station in Denmark that was a wildlife research station and called Kalo, K-A-L-O with a slash through the O, Kalo Game Biology Station, and it was on the Jutland, the mainland part of Denmark. And they had done a classic study where they had the deer were dealing with roe deer, the small European deer, and they had learned already that fencing and feeding them was not a good thing to do because you build up a population, then you couldn't start forests. It was forest plantations that they used to make money from the land that they weren't cropping with grains or other farm crops. And there the deer would overgraze the primary high-quality foods, and then in the wintertime they would be dependent upon, supplemental feeding, sugar beet pulp, for example, and because they grew a lot of sugar beets in those areas. And so this was a very interesting deal, and it turns out that there were a lot more deer on the land than the game wardens that were responsible in those days for estimating numbers of deer, that there were almost twice as many deer on the land, and not just there, but in other places in Denmark that were big private estates and manor houses said with big land holdings had deer populations. And so I was interested in that place and corresponded with them, and they asked, I even indicated an interest in coming over and doing some research with the roe deer, if I could get some leave of absence to do that, which I did. So then on that 1965 trip, then I made a point of visiting that station, and I sort of firmed up an arrangement to come back and spend 6 months with and bring the whole family with me and live there in this little village close to the research station and do the studies with the roe deer. And then I also, I think I went to, on that trip too, to the University of Kiel in Germany, where it had some correspondence from a PhD student, the professor of a PhD student, and the student wanting to come and do a postdoc with me at UAF. So I visited that place and met the student and interviewed him and sort of said we'd try to find funding to do this. And his professor was a classic guy who had, during the war, he had been in the German army. He was an officer in the German army in northern Finland, and he was fascinated with the reindeer and had published a couple of papers on that. Also was interested in the evolution of dogs from wolves. So he had captive wolves and was doing studies. At that time, they didn't know whether wolves were colorblind or not. They did studies showing that they were colorblind, and then did studies on brain structure of wolves versus dogs that were comparable size.
So wolves are colorblind?
Dogs too.
Dogs too.
Humans.
I don't know how you figured that out.
Primate.
It's off the topic, but.
Well, they did it with, like they did with pigeons and things. You had the captive animals and you put food in hoppers, and to get them, you had to peck a certain color hopper so the pigeons could detect different colors to get preferred food. Well, they did the same thing with wolves, where they had how to get into these little complex to swing a deal open. And if you spent your time working out and you got it open, there's nothing in there, then you're wasting your time. But if there was meat or good bait inside, but you had to, if you had the right, figure out the right color. So it showed that they can see sometimes shades of gray, but they're colorblind.
Hmm.
But then other studies subsequently, but if you look at the rods and cones and eyes of animals, shows that, you know, birds are mostly can see color, but mammals, among mammals, is primarily the primates. And the logic is that they were, a lot of the early primates were fruit eaters, and would be in the treetops, and anything brightly colored is probably fruit. And they were swinging around, and it would pay to, you could find these edible stuff fast. I found that out in the human case when I was working in Southeast, and the guy that worked with me, who I replaced, Sig Olson, he was colorblind, but he didn't tell me at the time. And we'd be out, and it was right during blueberry season, and he didn't have any problem with blueberries, but the red huckleberry, which is related to blueberry in Southeast, nice little red berries, he couldn't see them. They looked green like the leaves, or looked gray like the leaves. And so I'd be, oh man, look at these red huckleberries. He'd get frustrated because he couldn't
see them.
And he told me he was colorblind. And my own son turned out to be red-green colorblind.
Hmm.
And yeah, we were able to detect it very on because, you know, he knew where the red light on the stoplight was, and the green light.
Yeah, that's where we'd be a problem.
Yeah. So because he knew where they were placed.
Right.
And they were just different colors of gray. Well, you develop these skills.
Yeah, you learn to cope.
Yeah.
But so this research station in Denmark.
Yeah. So then I went there in 1967, I guess. With the whole family, and we left in the spring toward the end of the school year, got out a little early, and then we put them in the Danish schools, but the teachers didn't have any, in that rural school, didn't have any English understanding or very little, so the kids didn't learn too much, and it was.
Did they learn? They must have learned Danish.
No.
No.
They didn't, because they didn't weren't in school for any length of time.
No.
And they didn't. We were sort of weren't in with a few other kids in the neighborhood where we lived, but mostly weren't. Plus, there were a lot of other exciting things because one of the biologists I worked with lived close by, and he had all kinds of animals and ducks and geese and guinea fowl, and it was just, everything was interesting in that area. And there were three of them, and they had two or three kids that they got together with and played games. Kids can play games without knowing.
Right. So you were there
hide and seek and then kick the can or something like that.
Yeah, so you were there for 6 months, you said?
Yeah, a total of 6 months. And so then we came back in the fall, and
what were you working on there?
Then I did studies work in collaboration with the one biologist who was working, not the senior biologist who'd done this study, Anderson. He was retired. He still hung around out there, and he'd published well. But then there was another guy, a young guy, younger guy, who was in his 30s, that he was Strandgaard, Helmut Strandgaard. And he and I worked together, but he was working on population dynamics and doing some early radio coloring and with reflecting colors so that you could go out at night and count the deer with a spotlight when they weren't as in the forest, they weren't as frightened and we were in vehicle and when you were doing that, and they were used to people in vehicles, but not if you're walking. Mm. And so it was help getting started on how to do population estimates of deer in different portions of this research station, and in other areas. What I did was to do a study of vegetation that were being available for the deer to eat, and then compared the growth and body size of the deer during the hunting season when they were being harvested, and we could get animals to work with, and usually just getting weights and measurements, but also getting other indicators and some examples as well to see what they were eating. And then we had actually 1, 2, 3, 4 primary study areas, which made it interesting for me because these were on, one was on a castle, a famous castle, the land on this castle, that Egeskov was the name of the castle that the count who was living there with his wife was very supportive of his research and studies. He had also been involved in the resistance movement surreptitiously during the Nazi occupation. Then there was another big manor house, and with the person, that family that was managing it at the time, and they had all of these places had their game managers or game hunters, and they were the ones that lived on the estates and did counts of the animals and managed what areas might need to be protected so the crops wouldn't be destroyed for a while, and what kind of crops to use to try to. They valued the roe deer because they were so valuable for hunting, and you could sell game meat, and game meat was very popular in Scandinavia, especially in Denmark. So the roe deer, you could have to pay for hunting on these, unless you were a friend of the estate owner, and they'd sometimes. If you're hunting a trophy antlers, they were different in that they, among the deer family, they're the only one that has delayed implantation. So they have their breeding season in the springtime. And then they delay the implantation until later in the fall, and so then they have their young then in late winter. Hmm. And the winters are moderately mild there, and it's pretty unusual situation, but the males are territorial, which is unusual too for members of the deer family, and especially during the breeding season. They have this small cute little antlers. And, but again, antlers were focus of back from the monarchy, days of the monarchies, that hunting was restricted to the for deer and the roe deer and red deer and wild boar were all restricted to members of the monarchy and the nobility. So the farmers could own on farming land, they could shoot roe deer, and they did, of course. But the roe deer could live fairly compatibly with crops like sugar beets and grains, barley and wheat, because they really, when the wheat and barley would grow up to about 3.5 feet high, mm-hmm. and roe deer were not that big, and it was good cover. And they were small deer, so they didn't damage by trampling, whereas bigger, the red deer did do damage. And, of course, wild boar did a lot of damage once it got into the crops and fields. But and then they would have drives, usually in outside of the spring trophy hunting period. And then they would use villagers and bait, but usually when kids weren't in school, and they would get the kids and some adults, and they'd bring small dogs, short-legged dogs, mm-hmm. and then it was all under a very formal hunt where the actual shooters were mostly guests of the landowner, with the landowner, and they would you'd drive in mini buses and VW buses or pickups out to the field areas that they were going to, and field and forest areas. And the hunters, then the hunt was under control of these game guides, and they had these horns, hunting horns, mm-hmm. and they would, one of them would be responsible for posting where the hunters are going to be, and the hunters always could not shoot toward the forest. They had to shoot away from the forest. So you'd be along the edge of a road. You could shoot animals that were crossing the road as they were being driven by all these people with noisemakers, you know, the kind that your wooden ones you swing mm-hmm. around and make a lot of chatter, and they had bells, and then they had these short-legged dogs, which they would let go, and as they moved through the area, trying to flush all the game that was there, including the roe deer. And the roe deer, if they went as desired, and the people weren't spaced too far apart, of course, some of them always would sneak back. But this included foxes, red foxes, and pheasants. And at that time, you could shoot almost everything. And there was, you get a quick look as the animals came rushing out. And so any deer, whether it was adult or it would be, or well, it would be mostly a pretty well-grown yearling and adult, or male or female, didn't make any difference. And you could shoot wood pigeons, and they would come flying out, and pheasants, and usually any kind of pheasants. Occasionally, they might say you could only shoot male pheasants.
And this was all still happening in the 1960s when you were there.
Yeah, and then when everybody got in position, then they would blow their horns mm-hmm. in sequence to let everybody know that they're ready to go. They do that, and then Then they'd take a break for lunch, and the guests all went back to the manor house, and you had a very formal lunch. Well, it was a lunch, but it was you usually had some alcoholic beverage, probably wine, and a lot of smoking. And in those days, you know, then they'd pass around cigars and take a long lunch, and good food. Of course, it was a lot of Danish kind of open-faced sandwiches and things like that, a lot of variety, and not a formal dinner, but it was all prepared by women, some of whom had been hired for the help out for the hunt in an old kitchen in the castle. You know, it was really quite a nice deal. And then they'd go out doing another hunt in the afternoon. And then the end of the day, after you went to these other places that you covered, you wouldn't go back to the same areas. You'd go to new areas. And then there was a formality of bringing all of the game in and laying them out by the castle or the manor house on the ground. And the hunters, most of the hunters traditionally wore hunting clothing, which were khaki-colored special hunting clothing, which cost more. But warm stuff so if it was cold weather,
right,
it would be warm enough. And then they would, everybody would line up, and they stand there, the hunters all lining up, facing these animals that were laid out there, everything had been killed. And you do a count, you know, and all of that. And then these hunters would blow a special tune, and that was paying honor to these, traditionally, of these animals, respect for the animals and honor for them, so that, you know, there would be more in the future, but it was part of the tradition. Mm-hmm. And then people, hunters that had come and would have the option, or as guests, they would have the option of if they were guests, they would usually, the meat would belong to the, especially for the deer, belong to the landowner. And so they could they could give you the meat, but generally they would expect you to pay for it. And if you were a general hunter that had paid the landowner to be involved in the hunt, yeah, you paid for the hunt. And if you wanted to have the meat, you paid more for any of the meat. But you only paid for the meat that was actually harvested, but you paid for the opportunity to hunt.
None of it sounds very sporting. You know, to have animals all flushed out and you stand there and hunt isn't quite the same as tracking a moose for 2 days.
Well, but it depends on how you define sporting. And when you think about the European hunting with dogs, and you have a lot of people, and the use of dogs, it's similar to hunting coons down in the south with dogs. And there's skills involved in training the dogs properly and how you do the hunt and safety in hunting with a lot of people so that nobody gets shot.
Right.
And of course, when you use a shotgun when on the drive to hunt.
Oh, even for a deer or something?
Yeah, because you get a quick shot, and they don't want the bullets going long distances as well. But when you're hunting for trophy, then you use rifle.
Yeah. It also, in terms of from a game management perspective, those deer, were they domesticated? I mean, it doesn't seem like you're managing a wild population.
They're very wild. They were very wild, yeah.
So the game manager was like a wildlife manager managing a wild game population.
See, and the old German tradition was you fence this whole thing, the land, and that doesn't work. Okay, then you have to feed, and when you feed, you attract animals into one area, and they just clobber the vegetation as well as the other stuff, and to the point where it won't regrow. And so my studies were mainly a study in relationship to the history of the how they cropped the land, and that was a phenomenon of soils. So in the Kahlo situation, which was in the same on Thuin, there were forested areas where they made money by growing trees, and some of these forested areas were hardwoods, which was a native oak mixed hardwood forests, which is much better habitat than conifers. So Norway spruce was the primary conifer they used in those plantations, where they just provided a little cover, but they didn't, there was, when the canopy closed, there was nothing growing down there except moss on the forest floor, and they were open, so you could see, but the deer avoided those places, especially when there's a hunt. They went into brushier areas, or and sometimes there were fields and that with tall grains growing and covered there. In wintertime, outside of the hunting season, yeah, they were frequently in the fields, and then there would be piles of sugar beets stacked up that hadn't been later harvest, that they had enough, and they stacked it up.
Okay, so in Denmark, you were studying the land use aspects related to the deer?
Yeah, but this was often related to the one of the study areas. Let's see, four. One of the study areas was public lands. It was sand dune areas on the west coast of the Atlantic, big, beautiful beaches. And rarely, when you'd get warm weather, it was a great place to go swimming and the beach. But the sand dunes had been a problem for when they would move over croplands. But the sand dunes themselves, the sandy areas themselves, were not very rich soils, and all of the soils there had a higher sand content. So they planted it. They controlled the sand dunes by planting some exotic evergreen. I think it was a kind of pine that would withstand the high winds and the low fertility. And then they would use grass, beach grasses, to stabilize the sand dunes too. And they wanted to slow the wind down, and then the grasses wouldn't get blowouts, and the dunes would start moving again. So they made a lot more land available for agriculture, but it had to be fertilized heavily if you're going to grow any significant crops. So they would prefer areas that didn't have to be fertilized so heavily. If you're grazing animals on it, then they fertilize the land. But there were roe deer out there.
Really? Even in the sand dune area or in the crop land?
And both, but mainly there's good cover in this pine because they are shrubby kind of and go close to the ground. So it was a good hunting area. Well, what we're finding is that the biggest body-sized animals were coming from the area with the poorest soils.
That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't. It seems counterintuitive, right? However, we did the assessment of the soils as well, but the density of the deer out there was very low. So then, where I was able to show that the deer, where they had larger home ranges and larger territory size, and this was where Strandgaard's work with marking the deer and to get population density showed that density was low, but also the soils were poorer, and they had a bigger home range. They could be much more selective in feeding than when you had a high population and they're all confined to a much smaller area of good soils. So you could produce more deer under those conditions, but body growth was more limited to selecting the best quality forage. That is sort of like going Alaska, the best quality forage for the deer in southeast Alaska was up in the alpine areas where it was open and the sun could get to them. But it's only accessible to the deer when there was no snow covering it. But in my two study areas in southeast Alaska, they're both two islands of about comparable size. One island rose up precipitously into moderately high mountains with a lot of alpine vegetation, which was loaded with lush summer forage. And the other island didn't have as much alpine, and it had milder winters. So what happened is the deer population rose to a higher level on the coastal island, on the open coastal island, where when they get a snowstorm on the island close to the mainland, where the weather was close to a major river, the Sikkim, coming through the Coast Range Mountains, so you get a lot of winter weather coming through, like at Juneau, mm-hmm. the same way. And so what happens is the deer population would build up there in the mild winters on the big island with a lot of alpine forage, high-quality forage, but then it would crash when the heavy snows came because there wasn't a lot of good low-level habitat for overwintering. Plus, there was heavy snows. It made it harder for them to get what there was, and it would cover most of that they'd use in a normal winter. Whereas in the outer island, on the outer coast, it was so mild through the winters, and they didn't have extensive alpine. The deer were much smaller and stayed at a moderately high density. So the age structure was older, but it was being controlled by the food available. Well, it was the same principle on the mainland, but what was controlling food availability on the big island close to the mainland was that there was heavy snow, and the alpine was not available in the wintertime, nor was the other areas where, because of the deep snows. So you get big starvation in severe winters. This then would free the animals after the habitat was lush, whereas out on the coastal island, there were a lot of prime forage species that you could only find them where they're on a cliff or ledge or someplace that the deer couldn't get to. And so it was a similar phenomenon in Denmark, but for somewhat different reasons. But it was fascinating, and of course I learned a lot about Norwegian or Danish culture and historically, and most of these places where you could buy a permit to hunt, especially for trophy hunting. And one of the things was required for anybody hunting deer and roe deer or red deer, large game, you had to have a dog available that was trained to track a wounded animal. And that meant you could have them in the dog might belong to a friend in the neighboring village, and you could go there and get the dog. But you were required to track down and recover any wounded animals. So this was enforced strongly. And so if you had permission by the landowner to go up there, you can't just say to the landowner, well, I'm sorry, I shot one, but I couldn't recover it. Well, they'd say, well, where didn't you go with the dog? And if you didn't, you got a big fine. Mm. And usually, you know, some places, even some people that close to good hunting areas and lived there had dogs that were trained to this, they would charge.
Yeah, they'd make a little money that way.
Yeah, you come and rent the dog for half a day to go out there and track down the wounded animal.
Makes sense.
So that was, I mean, these are such prized animals. I mean, they had how many hundred years celebration of the founding of Copenhagen, and the king and queen put on a big dinner for everybody. And the roe deer was the primary food. Of course, they had lots of other food too, mm-hmm. but that was the primary food. And so that they had store up on roe deer for quite a while.
So what you learned in these studies was transferable to Alaska, or you were studying it just to learn more in general about the deer?
In general, a deer that could be transferable anywhere. And then I published a major paper on this with Strandgaard in the Journal of Wildlife Management. And but it was, he published other papers later on the population dynamics, but this was the major one on, and I was challenging a lot of European attitudes toward deer management on roe deer and red deer management. And so...
How were you challenging it? What did your work...
Showing that it wasn't just that supplemental feeding was not a viable factor, that... So I went through all of the historical stuff that they had there too, and showed that and Strandgaard had already making headway with you can't just use the old methods of estimating population by how many deer you see out on the feeding in the wintertime on a pile of sugar beets, and it's an index, but in the same way you go through the woods, I mean, it's just an index of what's out there. And if you know, if you have marked animals, you can get an idea of how many animals by the marked versus unmarked. And then what you see versus what you know, then when you're looking in other areas. But a lot of it was showing the difference on quality of different forage plants. And it was, part of it was the seasonality, which I'd already shown in Alaska with showing that the deer are very selective for plants initiating growth. And then you have different species that initiate growth at a different rate. And so they can move around and they eat different plant parts, you know, when they're growing, and they eat maybe the floral buds of some plants, and the same with caribou on the North Slope. So a lot of this stuff gave me information that I could apply when I started working with caribou and muskoxen and moose in northern Alaska after I came to the university.
Hmm. So did you like doing this work in Scandinavia?
Pardon?
Did you like this work that you did in Scandinavia?
Yeah, partly because I had learned from the very beginning that the first time I went there, that, yeah, people had different education, different background, good education usually, and the scientists, and they were familiar with our publications and they were all English speaking. So this of course led to my encouraging exchanges and getting students come over to do master's degrees and sending students over there. And it led to formal agreements. We had a formal agreement for a period of time with the University of Copenhagen. And at that time, the university, as part of that, they taught Danish courses here at the university. And then we had another one at that time it was the Norwegian Royal Agricultural College. And we had a formal exchange program, and that was mostly senior level students, undergraduates, that were just moving into a master's program. And yeah, it was mostly, in that case, mostly Norwegians coming here. It was hard to get Alaskan students over there, and the language was somewhat of an obstacle for them. Even though some went over and some did. You met Scott Brainerd?
No, but I've heard the name. You mentioned
him. Well, he works for Fish and Game now, right. But he did a master's. No, he did a undergraduate degree with us in wildlife. Then he went to Norway and did a master's over there, and they stayed and worked. I married a Ukrainian woman, and they stayed and worked for more than 10 years, worked his way up in the wildlife management when jobs were scarce, but he did a lot of good stuff wildlife management. Then they moved to back here, and now he's heading up the research for the Division of Wildlife Conservation here in this northern, the interior area.
What about for you? What did it mean to you to have these opportunities in Scandinavia? Both you personally and for your work?
Meant a lot of things. One, was important for me, the two times they're there with my family, was I felt it was really good for the family to be there, the children particularly. And my wife was interested in spending time in a foreign country and appreciated, for the kids to get there, and especially in Norway where the children went to Norwegian schools and by choice and learned Norwegian. My feeling was, I was learning more and more about cultures, different cultures, and European cultures, and diversity of cultures in Europe, all of interest to me, and this led to more and more connections and changes. Red Deer, for example, I was invited to go to Scotland and spend time there visiting with people at the University of Aberdeen who were working with Red Deer and habitat relationships. And then led to more and more exchange visits, and of course in the Fulbright grant, a travel grant that assisted me and the whole family to get to Norway for the sabbatical year under the Fulbright program in Europe. If you were in one of the countries that belonged to the Fulbright program, the European Fulbright program, they got notice of all of the people that were Fulbrighters in Europe at the time. And you were expected that you might be asked to give a talk or visit another country, and it was up to you whether you did it, whether you could fit it in or not. But if they invited you, they would pay your expenses to go and visit. And I did this during the 1971-72 year in Oslo. As part of the Fulbright program, I was invited to give lectures at, I think it was the University of Lund, the Swedish university, which was easy because it was a train trip. It wasn't too far. And then they, you know, they provided lodging and as well as costs of living and travel costs. And then I went to, I was invited to go to Northern Ireland, which, you know, people said, why do you want to go to Northern Ireland? Well, because I'd never been there. And it
why
was,
not?
I knew there was a university there, the new University of Ireland or Northern Ireland, was tried to stay aloof of sectarian disputes, religious disputes between people there. And that was a good experience. And I was seeing different variations in habitat in these different places. And then there was the invitation to Portugal. And that was far more than I had expected. And you know, it was sounded like a nice trip. And I thought, you know, what could I offer them from Alaska? But I was the only Fulbrighter in Europe at the time with wildlife training and wildlife management training in the U.S. And actually, I'd undergraduate work was in Connecticut, where some of the forest tree species were, and I did studies of forest types at the University of Connecticut, and so I was familiar with the oak forests that were being protected in this national park and
in Portugal,
but I became more and more fascinated with cultures, and especially mountain cultures in Norway, people living close to the land or sea, and had been subsistence living on small farmsteads from back in the Viking era, and the same in the mountains of Portugal and this national park area, which were just adjacent to Spain, where people were living in a similar pattern. And then, you know, got there and realized, well, yeah, they had roe deer there, but they were hunted down pretty low, but they were still could hunt them, and they had major hunting species were red-legged partridge, which are like the red grouse of Scotland or ptarmigan in Alaska, and that flock up in the non-breeding season and can be hunted with dogs, similar to the red grouse, and then they. These people living in the mountains, they were still living a sort of subsistence farming lifestyle with terraced fields on steep slopes, but they had a lot of granitic soils with good water springs and what. So they had good use of water, and they learned to use water well and direct it to the fields, and they used some traditional methods which of managing the land, which were not approved by the forestry ministry in Portugal. They didn't have, when I first went there, there was no wildlife program in the government. There was some foresters who, in fact, it was a forester who came up with the idea of protecting this area as a national park. And he was kind of looked down on by other foresters, and because it became apparent to him that forestry had moved into some of these areas and planted exotic trees, which were very fire prone and dangerous to put them in the landscape that they claimed was overgrazed by the local people. It wasn't really overgrazed by the local people. People grazed it, and then they sometimes would burn it to get rid of the shrubs that were wouldn't be eaten by the grazing animals, which were prickly, somewhat fire resistant, but not very fire resistant. And if they burned, they could set back that stuff. And then the local people sometimes would harvest some of the prickly stuff and use that for bedding in the barns and sheds for their sheep and cattle. And then it would be trampled on and collect the urine in it. And then it was good fertilizer to put, and partly decompose. They'd put that on these terraced fields, build the soils where they had usually spring water to provide the water, and they would grow vegetables, and they grew some grains, corn, maize, which was obviously introduced from the Americas, but they made a bread that was excellent, made out of corn and barley, and maybe a little bit of flour, wheat flour, that they would have to buy to get to rise a bit. So I became fascinated with the cultures, and especially cultures related to people living close to the land, whether they're farmers or subsistence people, farming and cutting wood and harvesting, grazing animals and taking advantage of, say, the acorns to feed their hogs, which they would let run, and the acorns falling from the oak trees. And, of course, wildlife used acorns, deer and wild boars as well. And so did the deer.
Well, as we've said before, wildlife management is bit of a misnomer because it's somewhat people management.
Right.
And all your examples here and, you know, in Portugal and elsewhere, the way the people were using the animal populations and the landscape was all part of the equation.
Well, yeah, and part of it was my undergraduate training at the University of Connecticut was in the sort of agriculture component, plant sciences. And so the forestry and wildlife were together in the forestry department. And I've always been interested in plants. And I used to fascinated with wildflowers. And my mother was really interested in wildflowers. And they bought me books on the identification of flowers. So I had this curiosity about plants and animals. And then, of course, it naturally worked together, the herbivores and habitat and understanding the habitat. I had a good background. I take systematic botany at the University of Connecticut, which was an excellent course and a very rigorous one, but I did very well because I was interested in it. And we went out and did plant collections and did identification. And I normally don't like to get too much satisfaction of just going out and collecting things and identifying it. But if there's a reason, then I did. And I began to become focused. Well, once invoke evolution, you can see the relationships between plants and families, just as between animals, species, and their evolution. So, yeah, to me, ecology and evolution, which I had good training at undergraduate level, and it bore big fruit in terms of my future and work and maintaining my curiosity, I watch a bird out of the bird feeder while I'm eating lunch, and I see behavior and I think, why would that behavior be selected for? Because I think in terms of the evolution.
Right.
And behavior is the key part of it.
Well, and also, as you say, your interest in plants and studying all that, I can see how that has led to your interest in habitat and your focus on habitat, because you're looking at the bigger picture. At all aspects, not everybody does.
My experience in working overseas, while I was with Cooperative Wildlife Research Unit, and then later the senior scientists with the Joint Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. We'd have our annual meetings of the unit leaders, and so I got to know other unit leaders, and had respect for all of them because I believed in the system, and mostly they did too. And so I suggested to our supervisor, we ought to have an exchange program within the cooperative unit program, because they're all over the United States, these units, and 39 of the states, I think, have them. And so I...
You think that idea for a cooperative, for the exchange, was based on your experiences in other countries?
Definitely. And because I had gained so much from that, that I realized that it's always good. It's sort of like, you know, if a student comes and does a master's degree with us and then wants to go on for a PhD, we encourage them to go elsewhere, not stay and do it. But sometimes their major advisor thinks, oh, this is a wonderful PhD student, let's go on. I think it would be better in most cases, not necessarily all, but most cases, if student went elsewhere, where there would be new advisors and new experience. And so this the supervisor that I want to connect with, Reed Goforth, he said, well, that sounds like a good idea. The problem is we don't have any budget to justify that, and it'd be hard to sell that. I said, well, what if, it doesn't, I'm not talking about long exchanges, maybe a couple of weeks at a time. And then if we can, mainly we'd need a little bit of travel money, but if we exchange between the unit leaders or unit and a leader and assistant unit leaders in another place, then the understanding would be they would put you up in their home, and we'd do the same when they came. Well, that's a good way to do things, because you can't expect someone to come big distances, and it's going to be costly for them to stay in a hotel, and it's boring to stay in a hotel. Whereas to stay with your colleague who you already know, and so you stay with the family, and that's good. That you get to understand subcultures and regions of the country, and they may not be from that era themselves, but they understand better and take you out. And we'd, on those exchanges, we'd take people that came, they'd have some time and interact with students at the university, but we'd get them out in the field.
Yeah.
And I'd try to time it for a field trip that would be a class field trip to have an extra person along, especially from another university. And everybody's perspective is different depending upon where you came from and what your training was. And so one with, the first one was Filipino, Alaska and Ohio units. People said, why would you want to go from Alaska to Ohio? Well, I wanted to go there to see how they carried out their program. And the guy was a guy that I established a close friendship right away. He's a top-notch guy, and they had a good record. And so, yeah, we looked at a lot of waterfowl marshes and learned about major problems and solutions to problems. And people living close to the land, but they still had, good hunting areas for pheasants and hares and deer. And then I did another one with the University of Arizona, and I've always been interested in desert habitat, because it's, again, adaptations of plants to a desert environment, and obviously the animals that live there, whether they're birds or mammals or what, have to have those adaptations. And so you have similar, you have deer that are adapted to living in a desert environment, which are quite different adaptations than in a rainforest in Southeast Alaska, where this water is not a factor. And plants, of course, have to be adapted to take advantage of the water when it comes and do it quickly, and then that hold on to those plants so that they can be foraged for. But they can't be foraged too much or they're not going to survive plants. So plant defenses against a river became an interesting focus, and we had some good research being done here, and I worked closely with those and with students that were interested in plant defenses against herbivory. And some of that continued to maintain contacts where they were doing a lot of good work like that in Finland, for example, at universities in Finland. And my interests were such that I wanted to go to international, not just wildlife-related conferences, but international zoological conference or the international ecological conferences in places like Rome and Japan and other parts of New Zealand and Australia, which broadened me, but also exposed me to more opportunities to learn and make connections with scientists working in similar or fields that were related, but the habitat was quite different. And so I became, more global in my experiences. At one point in the 80s, here I am working mainly with northern ungulates, with musk oxen and deer and moose and caribou and mountain sheep and mountain goats. But evolution of most ungulates occurred in Africa. And so, I thought, I'd really like to get to Africa. And so I was able to, it was harder to get away. Whenever I did one of these sabbaticals to Norway, I didn't get any salary. Mm-hmm. I had to go off salary. I had to use up accumulated vacation time and then get some support for living wherever I went. So in Norway, I did have support, and I did have to do a little bit of lecturing to get enough support so that I rented out their home and here in Fairbanks and had housing provided to the university there. So it was not easy financially, but a family was supportive and interested in doing it, so, and it worked out okay. And well, then the same with South Africa. I made contacts with key people at international conferences in Scandinavia, and I talked to people at the Mammal Research Institute at the University of Pretoria, which was run by an Englishman, a senior Englishman, but it was a mixture of Afrikaans and English scientists that worked there. But it had a good record, and so I asked about the possibility of going there visiting and doing some research. Well, I could only take off about 4 months, including travel time, from here, and in order to leave someone to cover while I was gone. Mm-hmm. And they put in a proposal from the national government in South Africa for me to come there and do some studies on water use in collaboration with one of their scientists there on water use, differential water use in habitat of two closely related antelopes, the impala and the blesbok, which is a bit bigger than the impala and lives in a very drier upland habitat, whereas the impala is a somewhat smaller, but and it's requires that it lives during the dry season. The seasonality of rain is all important there in Africa, and the seasonality of rain, they graze, are browsed on evergreens, shrubs and trees. And that they have a lot of secondary chemicals, and so they have to have a high turnover rate of water because they excrete most of these. They process the food, but they have a lot of these alkaloids and other substances that they have to get rid of in the kidneys and high excretion rate, and that means they have to be close to water and go to water at least once a day. Whereas the blesbok lives up in the highest upland plateau areas, which is good for grain production, and it doesn't have much forest. It's too dry. It's occasional scattered acacia trees, but it's mostly grassland and shrubs and plants related to grasslands. And during the dry season, there's often no available water, and they can actually adapted to get what water is present in living tissues of plants. They don't. It could include some low shrubs, but and they can go for many days without water. But their behavior is a lot different than the impala, even though they're relatively closely related. They're sort of sister antelope species, and the blesbok doesn't go to shade. At least it can stay out in the hot sun, and whereas the impala has to go to shade because they lose too much water if they are out in the bright sun with the hot, when the temperatures are well over 100 degrees during the hot period and dry period. But the impala just have to go to water as a group. And of course, there's some problems with going to water is if then you're vulnerable to predation by the big predators like lions, and mainly lions, but and hyenas as well. And because that's where the animals are aggregated. Yeah. And
hanging out and waiting.
Yeah.
And so how do you spell the blesbok?
Blesbok, B-L-E-S-B-O-C-K, I think.
Wait, B-L-E-S-C-O.
Bless, B-O-C-K, I think, blesbok.
Okay. I'll go look it up, but I needed some way to begin.
Right.
Frame of reference. Okay.
But they have, you know, some similar. The blesbok, which I didn't understand, didn't realize this was going to be the case, but they're similar to caribou. They both have nasal pot flies, parasites. And the other ungulates here, the moose don't have them, nor do deer. Other members of the deer family. And then there, it's uncommon for other antelope to have nasal botflies. So, you know, they have adaptations that seem to, when they sort of sneeze when they get rid of the flies, and of course that's what they do. The larvae, when they're developed, they get sneezed out and they pupate, and then the flies reinfect others. They also can let their body heat, like camels, get well above the normal, what's considered safe range for body heat. When that happens, they are lying down, not moving, not spending energy, but they're in effect building body heat. And then, especially in the dry season, in the winter, at the high elevations, it can get below freezing at night. Mm-hmm. And they gradually use some of that stored heat to maintain body temperature. They don't have to start drawing down on body fat or anything like that. And then in the, when the sun comes up again in the morning, they lie there, don't get up right away. They bask and start building body heat up a bit to a normal range. Then they get up and start feeding. So that the impala don't have that ability to let their body heat go at such extremes. But it's, you know, it's a good adaptation, obviously, in retrospect.
Right. Well, that's what's amazing about all these plants and animals. They, in evolution, they adapt and
right
to their environment.
And the different predator avoidance strategy, like there is between, say, muskoxen and caribou, the caribou having to be fast runners to get away from wolves before they get in close range. And the blessed buck love to be out. They don't like to be where there's any trees. They want it to be wide open so they can see any predators, and like cheetahs and leopards and lions and others. They don't want them to be close, and so they're going to be out in the middle of wide open spaces, and they stay together. They're social, and they'll all move together if predators, they see predators at the distance and stay well out of range where they can be attacked. And the impala is, you know, they're grazing in these open forests, mainly acacia and other plants, trees and shrubs. It's pretty open except for these trees, sort of savanna-like place. Well, it's obviously possible for lions and what to sneak up fairly close. So, and they're social too. And so when a lion, they're in smaller groups usually when they're out feeding, like 10 to 15, whereas the blessed buck would be somewhat larger groups. But at any rate, if a lion charges toward a grazing impala herd, they sponk.
What's sponk?
Well, sponk is, their behavior is they bound up into the air. You know, they're very agile, and they spring up into the air, and when they come down, they change their direction.
Oh, okay.
And they all do this, but they all going in different directions. So the lion is coming in there, and all of a sudden here are these things in there. It's hard for the lion to focus on one because it bounces and it goes off in the other direction, and there's another one, and it's doing the same thing. And it's sort of like birds' behavior when in a flock, when they're being attacked by a hawk. You know, the cranes, mm-hmm. you know, they flutter down and going in different directions. It works well to confuse the predator, and they're usually unsuccessful in those kind of cases.
It's interesting behavior, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It makes sense. So,
when they spronk, I mean, they could go up 10 feet in the air and then come down and go off in a different direction.
I've seen, you know, in nature programs, you see footage of that. And It's pretty amazing.
It is. It's impressive. Yeah.
Well, so how does studying these different populations, you know, the roe deer in Scandinavia and these antelopes in Africa, how does that influence your work and your thinking on the animals in Alaska that you've been studying?
It helps to use these for comparison in your own mind. So I published a paper after I came back and comparing the two species, both physiologically and behaviorally, the caribou and musk oxen versus blessed buck and the impala. So what I saw was that the musk oxen and the blessed buck were very similar in many ways, in their behavior, and they didn't stand their ground like the musk oxen, but they did. They weren't good runners, and as good runners as the impala, and they stored energy and were energy conservative primarily, whereas the caribou and the impala were both energy exploiters. They had to select for high quality food in order to get enough energy and food to maintain the very active lifestyle. And so we had the physiological, and some of the work I published there, I worked with the I can't remember his name now. A fellow who was, his father was a British sailor, I think, and his mother was a Dutch woman, Afrikaans Dutch. So he was part English, part Afrikaans and his heritage, and he had, but he was, he had done a lot of work with water turnover and other species. So we teamed up and we developed techniques. We had a fenced area right close to Pretoria that had stocked with wildlife, without big predators, but there were blessed buck and impalas there, and there were watering places so that they could go to water if they needed. But the question was, we wanted to use, this was a place where they weren't hunted, and therefore we could use stable isotopes and studying the animals. And he was trained in using stable isotopes. And I had some experience working with Bob White here in Alaska. And so what we, when we're doing stable isotope work with the musk oxen out here, or caribou, you'd have to collect urine in some way. Well, if you had them in a stall or something, that wouldn't be too difficult. You have a stick with a cup on the end of it and get some urine, and then you could put it in a vial and test it to see what the turnover rate of water was. And you could, another way would to draw blood, of course, before you injected the stable isotope, and then some 2 or 3 days later you could look at the blood, but the urine was a simpler way and less invasive if you could do it. Well, you can't, these animals were, although it was fenced, they were not tame by any means. And even though they weren't big predators, you had to be careful. We mostly would drive around little dirt roads and observe the animals and get data on movement to the watering, what, and feeding, and in relationship to temperature. And so we wondered how are we going to get stable isotopes. Well, I suggested, this water, and I was collecting some fresh feces, and what about the feces? A stable isotope would be, we'd need the water from the feces. And so it'd have to be real fresh. And that was
weird.
Could have been a bird, but it shouldn't have been. Well, it's in migration now, that could be a bird. A lot of juncos have been hitting the window, but I've only seen one that's been killed so far. But I should go out and check that one, see if it's out there. But so what we did was we had to dart the animal, give it an injection of the stable isotope we're using, which was usually tritiated water, and then what we did is took some colored tape and we'd put a tape the antler with different colored tape, like duct tape,
mm-hmm.
and so we could identify the animal. And then we did that as a team, but then he was doing other things. I would go out there, and my job was to watch this animal with the taped, and the minute it drops a pellet group of feces, when the summertime they were sort of sticking together in one chunk, and where there was water available too, and then to get out of the little mini pickup I had and keep my eye on that spot where and walk out there and pick up that fresh deal with a plastic Ziploc bag, and then we could extract the water from that and use tests on it. And that paid off. We got able to do that and didn't have to go on handling the animal again. And that was affecting the behavior a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that successfully and published a couple of papers on that, the water turnover rate of the two species, and based upon this stable isotope work, as well as observations of how often they would appear to go to watering.
Well, yeah, it sounds like some of the value of these international experiences, it's not just studying another animal, but working with the other scientists and getting ideas and learning from each other.
Yeah, and learning new techniques. Yeah, yeah. And especially that stable isotope work was really important.
That with science, part of it is the talking to each other and brainstorming and
right
idea development that comes from working with other
scientists. The institute was great for that, because we would have a coffee and a break that was standard. There was you always sort of tried to take to be there, unless you're right in the middle of an experiment in the lab or something like that. You could go there, and so there were. There was the people who were doing work somewhat related to yours, but sometimes not. And there was this one professor on leave from Israel who was working on porcupines. And the porcupines there are a different kind of animal than the porcupines in North America, in the Americas, and they have huge quills, and they're social. They'll be in a group, and their defense is they don't throw their quills like a porcupine, not throw them, but they don't have a tail that slaps a predator. any big predator tries to grab one, it has to deal with these very tough, big quills that are similar. They stick in and don't come out easily. And so it's big predators just avoid them. They're nocturnal normally, but they also are out in open areas in the, they do a lot of basking in the sun in rocky places where during the daytime when they're not active, that's where they hang out usually. And so that they were doing studies on water turnover rate in these basking porcupines. They had some captive colony of them, and they were, you know, they were relatively easy to tame down as individuals and work with them in a captive situation. But it was a lot of lab work for that.
But I don't know that all scientists value collaboration. A little bit of the stereotype is the guy, you know, sitting in their lab doing their little experiments. And so is that common to do collaboration like you've done, or is that more unusual?
It is for specialists working on, say, bear ecology or something like that, and or wolf ecology, but mainly in North America, bears are one where there's been good collaboration, and sometimes with physiological studies on ungulates, on elk, for example, and deer. So there were some of that carried through here, and I could, you know, I could take some pride in that I helped to stimulate it, but it wasn't just me. I mean, it was other people here with the Large Animal Research Station that were doing physiological studies, and then there would be an annual, every 2 years there'd be a conference on wildlife physiology, usually on ungulates, and sometimes here in Alaska, but sometimes down in mainly Colorado, where they were doing at the Colorado State University, they were doing a lot of the state biologists there were doing a lot of work with physiology of mountain sheep and deer and antelope. And then the professor at the Washington State University at Pullman, he, working with a PhD student, did Kathy Parker, did a lot of pioneering physiological studies where you actually, they built devices instead of bringing in animals like they had here at UAF into a closed chamber, and you could monitor the respiration and all of the air that's exhaled. You can extract oxygen, et cetera, or CO2 and determine turnover rates through respiration and respiration rates, because you can see the animal. You can even, they would have treadmills inside these. So they put the animal on a treadmill and work them, and they have a mask on so that they could collect all the air exhaled. And that turned out that this Charles Robbins, who had published a book on this, and the woman, a grad student, Kathy Parker, went on to become while she was still doing her PhD, she worked here with some deer studies in Southeast Alaska. And so then there were good connections between Robert White and research at this station, and work that was done with her and her partner, maybe her husband by then, who was a Canadian, also working on behavior and relationship to physiology from the University the other one in Vancouver, but I forget, not the University.
University of British Columbia? No.
No, the other one, University, I'll think of it, but it's younger, but a good one doing good.
Not Simon Fraser.
Simon Fraser.
Okay.
Yeah. And at any rate, so this established a lot of connections. And then Kathy and her husband, then Mike, did a postdoc here where part of the time Mike was working with me with some moose studies on the Kenai, on the Last Seward Peninsula. Kathy was working mainly with the large animal research with Bob White and others. And Kathy continues, she's now on the faculty, both of them are on the faculty at Northern British Columbia, the University of Northern British Columbia, and they were instrumental in, along working with us here, in establishing an exchange, arrangement with the University of Northern British Columbia, which is a fairly young university, where they have a heavy focus on forest ecology. And they've been doing great work there with wildlife and studies there. But when they're on postdocs here, they lived out at the research station, and then he worked in the field with me out in the Seward Peninsula and my students. And Kathy continues to work with Perry Barbosa mm-hmm. on physiological work and comes up here usually once a year and for a week or so. And so, you know, this, I have a lot of pride in the biology and wildlife and Institute of Arctic Biology and how they work together. And this international and national collaboration, and Canadian as well, has been very strong, and it's been a strong part in the past for the Institute of Arctic Biology. And I think we can say the, you know, the Tulik Field Station is a good example of the growth, outgrowth of some of these early studies. And while it was Alaska was a young university too, and that's, and we had all these challenges associated with resource development, like mm-hmm. especially oil development on the North Slope. And so we played a important role, I think, and I feel a part of that, but as a contributor and collaborator with others here. Sometimes we would argue and disagree strongly, but we respected one another and collaborated frequently and co-authored papers and put on conferences together jointly. There was a team, and that was what gained us recognition for the Cooperative Wildlife Unit, that here in Alaska we were doing what was intended for these units to be most effectively of any in the nation. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, some of them were good units, but they were so on campus, everybody thought of them as the feds, and they were separate from the academic, and the students were separate. It wasn't a good program, a good relationship, I didn't think, in those cases.
Those were in other places it was like
yeah.
that.
No, it's worked well here.
Now, you just said something about the challenges faced by resource development and how you feel like you played an important role. What do you mean by that?
Well, there was a lot of pressure on the university to respond to critics by some of us, but also environmentalists in general, that we didn't have adequate, the development industry, mainly the oil industry, but it's been including others since then, mining and forestry in Southeast Alaska, that we didn't have, there wasn't enough, the pro-development interests and the industries themselves didn't have enough knowledge of how to do things or directions by the management, the responsible agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Service or the State of Alaska, and components or Bureau of Land Management, et cetera, national parks and wildlife refuges, that we didn't have enough knowledge about wildlife and wildlife habitat relationships and how they might respond, the wildlife population might respond under development, both short-term response as well as longer-term response. So that meant we were in a position to get better funding to address these issues, but also we were under fire to do good science to address these questions. And so we realized that any research we do would be highly scrutinized in case results were not pleasing to the oil industry, for example, or other development interests.
So you feel like the unit and the university helped provide some good science that, for background behind all these development projects?
Yeah, that helped minimize the impact of the developments. And certainly the oil field itself, in spite of problems, when you realize the magnitude of the whole operation, it could have been much worse. And it was pretty bad just getting started because there was little understanding about permafrost and damaging the habitat and landscape, and what were the thermokarst and continued degradation and dust from the roads and the vegetation, and you just don't put oil on the roads to keep the dust down because that flies out when it gets muddy instead of dust.
They did in some places.
Yeah. Oh yeah, there was trial and error, and some couldn't be on top of everything instantaneously. And there was, during the pipeline construction, this joint federal-state wildlife team whose job was to make sure the oil industry stuck to existing regulations and also look for problem areas and maybe recommend changes to try to where they hadn't anticipated there would be problems, but there were, and how to continue to do the operation without shutting down the construction of the pipeline and try to minimize impacts. And of course, some of the impacts weren't that easily resolved. Some of the things about feeding wildlife, for example, by not taking care of garbage properly, or deliberate feeding by truckers and stuff. And the big problem was, of course, there were so many subcontractors, and the industry said it's unrealistic to think that we can control the subcontractors, and we could, the government could say, and did at times say, well, that's the way it goes. You better control them or we're going to have to shut it down.
Yeah.
One big problem was helicopter pilots, which were employed on short-term basis out of Fairbanks or something when they had a need for more, sometimes just flying people around, and then they were harassing wildlife, taking their pictures, and they didn't realize they were doing damage. And so we ended up that these pilots had to, if they're going to do any flying like that, they needed to go through a training period. And if they didn't want to do that, they would go to another company, and they would.
Right. Well, it's getting late. I think that might be a good place to stop. And I know you've done a lot more internationally, so we'll continue, I think, the next time with some more of that.
Sure.
And some more of those details, if that's okay.
Yeah, and then we can mention the official exchanges, visits under the, Nixon, Brezhnev exchange agreement, a science exchange agreement, and later it became included the humanities. But I was involved in three visits over there, and we hosted at least three of their visits over here. And that was challenging and interesting.
Okay.
I mean, when I look back on it,
Hold off.
Yep.
We'll do that next time.
Yep, fair enough.